evil lurks in the hearts of men.
Terrible Tommy knows, and
I sure know about all that evil around, I'm telling you. Hey, this is Terrible Tommy in the bunker out on the left coast. No, the west coast. And we're ready to do another show, but get your donations in. Yeah, get those donations in. Man, I want to go down and live on the Riviera, lay on the stars and look at the beach. Yeah. Send it to, let's see, P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, California, 92583. You do that and I'll be a happy boy for a while, but not too long.
There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
And now that you're comfortably in the Twilight Zone, let's move on to crazy Max Kaiser and get a little bit on that rotten bastard, what's his name? Well, they're all rotten bastards, so listen to this about how you've been fleeced and how you don't understand why they don't like racial separation. You just don't understand that, or you don't understand it properly. There's plenty of separation between the poor and the rich. And that's what we are now, the poor and the rich. Forget that middle class, it's almost gone. So when anybody says, you're for racial separation, that's no good. Well, we say financial separation is even worse, and that's what causes most of the trouble. Who's got all the money and who don't have any money? Okay.
Stacey?
Hey, Max. Actually, we're going to be here for a few days, and we're going to have a few episodes of Kaiser Report from on stage. We're going to talk about Bitcoin. We're going to talk about Jamie Dimon. We're going to talk about J.P. Morgan and Bitcoin. You're also going to have a debate with Peter Schiff about Bitcoin and gold. We're going to talk about satellites and why all these people like the SpaceX sorts, the Elon Musks and Jeff Bezos of the world want to like flee the planet. I guess if you look at all the hurricanes and earthquakes all over the world, I could see perhaps maybe they have some inside information about why we need to get X-Planet soon.
Well, you know, satellites offer a unique opportunity for synchronicity. If you've studied Carl Jung or, you know, contemporary of Freud, he approached the mind as the mandala, as everything being part of this kind of mandala or zodiac of symbols and symbology that essentially time doesn't exist. Everything is happening at the same time everywhere, instantaneously and eternally. And that's what the satellite will bring us, is this moment of synchronicity where time will cease to exist and we'll shed our egos as a species and the collective id will rise. We'll stop driving combustion engine cars and we'll embrace sex bots.
Okay. Well, speaking of symbology, I do want to say we're recording at the Aspen Institute, and I'm looking at a weird symbol, a sign, a poster there saying join NSA. We are speaking in the Booz Allen Hamilton Hall at the Koch building, so maybe this is all part of some sort of AI practice.
Aspen has beautiful women, and beautiful women attract all the high-powered men. That's been the way since the beginning of time.
Right.
They come over here, and they look for Mrs. Wright.
So,
well, Mrs. Wright now, whatever the case might be, you know what I'm saying?
So let's talk about, you know, you mentioned powerful men. There is the most powerful man in America. He acts like a bimbo ukulele player, but his name is Warren Buffett. And he said that anybody who shorts America is a loser. It's been a losing bet for a long time, he says. And Zero Hedge did some interesting numbers because the screaming headlines were that Dow is going to go to 1 million. So Warren Buffett predicts Dow 1 million, but there's a catch. Sounds great, doesn't it? Sounds like big number, right? In reality, Dow 1 million in 100 years would indicate an abysmal CAGR of just 3.9% pre-tax, or closer to just 3% post-tax returns per year, assuming tax rate don't trend towards 90% over the next 100 years. So the capital appreciation would not actually keep up with inflation.
Well, talking about bubbles, you know, Warren Buffett lives in a magical bubble where he never has to deal with the consequences of his actions, essentially. Look at the Wells Fargo Bank. He's a big investor. They became an orgy of larceny, destroyed lives, and he said nothing, did nothing. Look at the environmental holocaust that he helps finance and fund. Does it wash up in Arkansas? Where is he? The Oracle of Omaha, Nebraska. Does it wash up in Omaha? You know, no. The hurricanes are in Florida. Warren lives, and he's a ferryman. He lives in a ferry bubble, and he gets free money from the government. He takes monopoly positions. He ends up destroying the American economy and playing his ukulele. It's like Nero playing his fiddle.
Exactly. Actually, we have a headline about Wells Fargo next, but looking at this Dow 1 million, in fact, if it kept up with the same sort of rate of return that the markets have had since 1980, it would be Dow 140 million in 100 years. But he's saying it's only going to be Dow 1 million. The chart shows that, taking a look back, the Dow has returned 5.7% annually over the past 100 years and 9.3% annually since 1980, when the modern era of equity bubbles first started to take off. So the chart is really quite amazing that you see since the 1980s, returns have skyrocketed.
Well, pursuant to this point, what Mr. Buffett has done recently, which I do give him credit for, is he made a bet with the hedge fund industry that over a 10-year period of time, an index fund, passive fund, would outperform any hedge fund over that period of time. One guy stepped up, they took the bet, and the hedge fund lost. You know, something we've said many times, the hedge fund industry is a scam, essentially. None of them have ever outperformed the market over any length of time in any meaningful way, except for maybe George Soros. That's about it. Maybe one or two other. Buffett himself has outperformed, compounding money at 22% over 35 years. But other than that, every single hedge fund that's ever been created has been a scam.
Yes. Well, he won that bet. Did the guy actually pay up?
Yeah, it ended up money going to charity. I think the money that Buffett had going to was the Girl Scout cookies or something. Girl Scout cookies. You know, the guy knows how to play to the crowd. He knows how to, get the government behind him when he goes in there and he defrauds millions of people out of their hard-earned cash. He knows how to play the game.
Well, another point to make about his claim that we will see Dow 1 million and that you shouldn't short America is that all the best returns in the Dow have happened since the 1980s and deregulation and the explosion of debt and credit in the economy. But here's a remarkable story. Post-Equifax. You know, Equifax is one of these consumer credit rating agencies that rates the trust, the creditworthiness of the individual American, and they use that based on your unique ID that the government gives you, the Social Security number, birth, and they were hacked many months ago, and apparently all that information is out in the wild. So here's Wells Fargo advising their customers. Holy moly, now Wells Fargo recommends a credit freeze, an Equifax hack. When a bank encourages its customers to get a credit freeze and refers them to a federal government website that shows how to go about doing it, people take notice. Other banks may already have posted similar information to encourage their customers to protect themselves or may soon do so. This is Wolf Richter, and he's saying that this is quite extraordinary because Wells Fargo is the third largest bank in America. They make their money by churning clients and getting them to take credit card debt, to take mortgages, to take home equity extraction loans, to take, you know, auto loans, all of this stuff. This is how they make their money. And they are advising their customers right now to lock their account, to actually put a credit freeze on. This is what they emailed their customers, saying you should go to Equifax and put a credit freeze on. So if Warren Buffett's vision of Dow 1 million is to even come true, forget the 140 million that it would be if it stayed at the same sort of annual returns as the past 20, 30 years. But if he were to see 1 million Dow in 100 years, you rely on an ever-increasing amount of credit. And here is Wells Fargo Warren Buffett is the largest shareholder of the third largest bank in America, and they're advising their customers to freeze their credit.
It reminds me of that quote from the film Malcolm X by Spike Lee, Denzel Washington playing Malcolm X in a speech in Harlem saying that we didn't land on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Rock landed on us. So for Warren Buffett, he's the landed gentry living on the right side of the interest rate apartheid wall. He never has to deal with the scams, the larceny, the malfeasance of Wells Fargo Bank directly. He's cashing in on their criminality. And this credit freeze recommended by the bank, part of the Equifax catastrophe, is similar to these, like Hurricane Irma. This is a hurricane in the credit markets brought on by moral hazard writ large. When Alan Greenspan talked about moral hazard as being necessary component to the markets to allow a little wiggle room, to allow banks essentially to break the law to keep liquidity going, something that we hear from Goldman Sachs all the time, telling people that we need markets to be liquid, therefore we need to be able to commit fraud without penalty. Well, this is what happens if you have decades and decades of fraud, is you end up with this Equifax disaster, because the people who committed these crimes at Equifax, they know that there's no penalties for them. There's no deterrent for them. That they're simply scraping billions out of the system, leaving the wealth and income gap in America to widen, to scream to levels that are unprecedented. All the violence in the street. Buffett says, never sell America short. Well, you know, he's not dealing with the consequences of the riots in the street, the violence, the murders that he's causing by not helping to put a check on this moral hazard that's become the fraudulent de facto business model of America. He's the Pol Pot, essentially, of fraud.
Okay. We have a lot of Pol Pots of fraud.
There's a lot of Pol Pots of fraud, and he's the most charming of them all. What was that movie, The Killing Fields? Remember, running across all those dead bodies. That's what it looks like in Omaha. Once you leave Warren Buffett's liar of lies, there's dead bodies all the way across, headed to Wall Street.
Dead credit, for sure.
Dead credit!
Now, of course, one thing to put into context, you talk about the wealth and income gap in America, and the fact is that it's something like 60% of Americans have less than $400 or something like that, and most of them don't have enough money if there was some sort of emergency requiring $600 for, say, a medical situation or a car problem, so they would have to rely on credit. But if you freeze your credit, as you must do now, because most 60% of Americans were hacked, all their information is out there. So if you freeze your credit, it takes days to unlock. It takes weeks to lock it, and then days to unlock it.
Right, the entire system is run on credit. And now they're saying to freeze the credit.
Yes.
Okay, just like they're treating Americans like they treat Iran, or they treat WikiLeaks. So Americans don't understand that they're on the same page as Iran. They're on the same page as WikiLeaks. That they are on the short end of the stick. They're being abused by these financial guys on Wall Street and Warren Buffett, who are using their access to credit and the corrupt monetary system to impose a political order that supports biological holocaust, eco-holocaust, social demise, and social re-engineering, ethnic cleansing, social cleansing.
Okay, and the whole industrial sort of system here, you know, nobody makes money selling cars, nobody makes money selling clothes, nobody makes money selling food. What they make money is selling the credit to access that.
Financialization.
So now they're saying is like, when you go into a retail outlet, the few that remain that have not been destroyed by private equity, well, if you go into there, they often say, here, you know, get a 10% discount if you take out the store credit card. Well, now it's not going to be possible because most people are going to have their credit frozen so that no new applications can be applied.
We got to go, but it's, you know, we're heading into the casino gulag model, where you don't have any credit. The only thing you'd have is you can click likes on Facebook for tokens to buy French fries. And that's it. That's your life. It's prison. It's an open prison. It's freaking Gaza, for the entire America has become Gaza.
Okay, well.
Thanks, Warren Buffett! We got to go to the.
You may have noticed I like eccentric people. And if they're politically eccentric, I like them even better. Max is eccentric. He's crazy, man. Look, so that's what I was getting across to you. one thing we hadn't really talked too much about in a direct way is the separatism that exists in this country and has always existed. They don't want to be along with racial separatism. That won't make them much money. In fact, it would make them less money. They want economic separatism, the super rich and the poor. And that's what they do in every country that they get a hold of since time begun. So if you want to know who's the problem, you got about 1% in this country, maybe 2% of the population that are the super problem, the super separatists. I saw a little blurb the other day about this situation in Las Vegas. I don't read too much of it because there's so much craziness out there, it wastes your time. In fact, somebody sent me some new conspiracy theory, and it's one of the old right-wingers. I'm not going to say his name, but I said, who cares? Really, who cares? There's nothing you can do to make it happen. Nothing you can stop it can do to stop it. So most of the people involved and even hurt and killed were not supporting our position. So I think we have to be a little crass about it. You know, that pisses off a lot of people. You're supposed to love the baby Jesus, but I don't love that non-existent baby Jesus. And if people aren't for us, they're against us. And so really, what the hell do we care what happened in Las Vegas? People got to understand that if you hang out in places where there are lots of people from now on, and in the past too, you're liable to get killed. That's just the way it is. So if you want to make sure you're safe, stay home. Watch a movie on TV. Incidentally, it came out supposedly, here's supposedly, because I don't trust any of this crap, that his girlfriend, the Filipino, was a Muslim. Well, since she was from Philippines, it's a good chance she was a Muslim or is a Muslim. Which brings back to out of the cobwebs of my brain a few things. Remember Tim McVeigh? You all thought he was a racist? He wasn't a racist. Him and his brother were both cohabitating or screwing Filipino women. I think his brother was even married to one. So what is this thing with the Philippines? You know, the Philippine women are probably the most ugly of all the Asian women. Now, there are beautiful Filipino women, but not that many. So anyhow, here we had the guys who dropped the Morar building hooked up with the Philippines. There was another guy who contacted me years ago with some kind of a cryptic cult type deal they'd started down in the Philippines. It wasn't exactly racist. In fact, I think that's what we differed with them, but it was a cultish right wing thing that I wish I'd have saved some of that paperwork I downloaded off the internet because it was weird stuff. They got angry with me because I wouldn't go along with their cult type thing. I don't go along with cults. So anyhow, that was down there, and then the thing about the right wing cartel and the Japanese gold that they were looking for off the Philippines. And who else? There was some other stuff about that. But it seems that the Philippines is a very interesting place with American politics and the right wing and a lot of other people. So, strange, strange indeed. It is interesting that allegedly this fellow that did all the bang-banging up there in Las Vegas had planned and he had rented or taken reservations at a couple of other great big venues, the one back east that had about 40,000 people usually attend. That's interesting. I think that was in Chicago. So he may have been planning to get up on the high building and crank off some more. That's interesting. But you can't tell me that a guy just woke up and did it. There was nothing really super duper in his past or on his mind. There's something going on there. And here, his girlfriend was Muslim. Well, there's a link there. Maybe there's something going on. But I'm not going to get into it because I don't want to get back into the crazy right wing and the left wing trolls, because they go crazy. Yeah, they do. I'm gradually unpacking and filing a lot of my papers from back in Indiana. They've been sitting on a shelf for about 5-6 months now. I figure it's time to straighten out things. And I just happened to run across a couple of things. This was in this Blade Citizen newspaper, and it was on November 29th, 1990. Headlines: Metzger cronies eyed in bombing. San Diego, federal authorities are investigating associates of Fallbrook white supremacist Tom Metzger in connection with the September bombing of the downtown federal building, Metzger said Wednesday. They make it sound like they knocked the whole building down. Actually, all they did was the guy that did it just cracked the windows on the plate glass doors in the front of the place. That's all he did. Metzger denies any role in the incident, in which a pipe bomb shattered two glass doors in the early hours of September 15. But authorities have subpoenaed at least one Metzger associate, Carl Strait, otherwise known as Bone Crusher, of San Diego, to appear before a federal grand jury December 20th. Now, Carl was a heavy-duty street fighter. Don't get in a fight with Carl Strait. Well, he used to, when the feds would come around to him and flash their badges, he would look them in the eye and say, "Where'd you get that, Toys R Us?" They didn't like that. Metzger, leader of the Fallbrook-based white Aryan resistance, provided copies of the subpoena to the press, and he said the FBI agents have interrogated Strait. Metzger also said two other associates whom he would not name are subjects of the investigation. Strait has served nearly 20 years in Metzger's movement as everything from Santa Claus to bodyguard, said Metzger, a former Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. Yeah. Ludicrous to think we'd be involved with that kind of activity. That doesn't get you anywhere, Metzger said. That doesn't mean I have any love for the Federals. I'd still like to take a wrecking ball to that federal building. Assistant U.S. Attorney Larry Burns and prosecuting attorney in the case refused to comment on the grand jury case, citing federal secrecy laws. Like this government could ever keep a secret? That's the funniest thing in the world. They want to keep a secret. Authorities began pursuing a possible Metzger connection shortly after the bombing, when television station KNSD received a letter signed by the Holy Church of the White Fighting Machine of the Cross. That's a long one. The Holy Church of the White Fighting Machine of the Cross that claimed responsibility. The letter demanded a halt to a wrongful death suit against Metzger that claimed that he and his son, John Metzger, incited the beating death of an Ethiopian man who was black at the hands of white supremacists in Portland, Oregon. An Oregon jury has since found that Metzger is liable for $12.5 million in damages, to which Metzger said, "I just wrote him a check." The grand jury in San Diego later charged an Ocean Beach man, Mark George Soames, was sending the letter to the TV station, as well as sending other threatening letters to Alabama lawyer Morris Dees, who tried the case against the Metzgers. "Thanks for your help, buddy." And to Roberto Martinez, a prominent Latino rights activist from San Diego. A federal court last week released Soames on a $100,000 bond with the condition that he check into Alcohol Rehabilitation Center, Burns said. The prosecutor would not say whether Soames is a suspect in the bombing. His case on the mailings will likely go to trial in January. Soames had made phone calls to Metzger, Burns said, at the time of his arrest in October. "Well, they must have been tapping my phone at the time," But I didn't remember the guy. You know, I used to get a lot more weird calls than I do today. It's been surprisingly peaceful. Metzger said Wednesday that he knew Soames through phone conversations that Soames had subscribed to Metzger's newspaper, War. Yeah. Okay, let's see. That's it. Well, you know, I've been running the gauntlet several times, as you know. I'm a couple of federal grand juries, along with the usual suspects. Butler, Miles, Beam, and me, we've been before federal grand juries at least two times, maybe three. And of course, I always took the fifth, never answered a question other than name and my address. And I always walked. I keep telling people, you can't go to a grand jury and talk, especially when usually they've got you in there because you're also a target along with who they're really after. But most of these right-wingers don't have enough brains to do that. They yap to the feds when they scare them to death, you know, and they go before these federal grand juries and cry their eyes out and all that kind of shit, even when they're innocent. So what can you do? You can't fix stupid. 14.5, you always, you do not talk. You can't hurt yourself by not talking. Well, they're going to think I'm guilty if I don't talk. Oh, what stupid bastards. Even important people with lots of money make that mistake, like that lady that was into the television cooking show. What was her name? Anyhow, she lied to the FBI agents when all she had to do was not say anything. She lied to them, and she got 3 or 4 years in prison for nothing. Well, here's an old yellowed clipping that fell out of my off the shelf here while I was cleaning up. Fugitive arrested near Rogers, Arkansas. Another reputed member of the neo-Nazi group, The Order, was arrested at Safari Campground near Rocky Branch late Monday night on federal racketeering warrant. See how they use that federal racketeering, supposedly just for the mob. Now they use it against anybody. Frank Lee Silva, 26, of Los Angeles, was arrested while camping with his wife, his daughter, and their dog on Beaver Lake, according to the Benton County Sheriff's Office. Silva, as he was led from the jail to a waiting car at 11 a.m. this morning, admitted to being a member of the Order. He was booked into the county jail and was transported to Fort Smith the morning for a court hearing. When he was arrested, about 10:30 p.m., authorities found an automatic rifle, I'm sure it was semi-automatic, and a fully loaded 30-round magazine at the scene, according to news release from Sheriff's Office. Silva was a federal fugitive and a known member of the Aryan Nations, according to the Sheriff's Office. The Order is an offshoot of that group. The Order is also known as the White American Bastion and Brüderschaft Wagen, German for Silent Brotherhood. 23 alleged members of the Order were indicted in Seattle Monday, including Silva and Artie McBurdy of Gentry, who was arrested April 4th at his home. McBurdy used to be just a tax rebel, got mixed up with the Aryan Nations, and after he got arrested, he cried like a baby. And I remember his wife being there when the hearings were on in Seattle, because I went up there and I was there. And she was just going, oh, crying and crying, oh, man, he wouldn't do that. He's totally innocent. And I got sick of hearing her. Anyhow, there's more to that article, but it's sort of got creased in the wrong place and it's hard to read. Frank Silva did approximately 10 years in federal prison, which to some people might seem to be sort of short, but when you're doing the time, it isn't. Of course, you could entertain yourself like I did in the L.A. County Jail for 45 years. I said, you got any TVs around here? And the sheriff guards, he said, "Yeah, we got two or three down there in the closet, and they don't work." I said, "Well, I'm a TV man. Let's get one out and bring it down here in my cell." So the sheriff actually took me down there to the closet and got a TV out of the cupboard there and took it down to the cell. I got it working. So then my cellmate and I had TV for 45 days. Yeah. Well, as many of you may know, of course the newcomers probably wouldn't know, but I was a good friend of Colonel Gale, William Potter Gale. I used to attend his radical church up in the Masonic Temple up in L.A. Yeah, Mason's Temple. In fact, I think he was a Mason. But anyhow, I thought he was a good man. I still think he was a good man. He was the youngest colonel in the Philippines under MacArthur. And when MacArthur left the Philippines, the Japs were closing in. He left Colonel Gale to command these local Filipinos up in the mountains against the Japanese. So he was quite a hero. He ran for governor once, too, of California. But anyhow, I liked him, and he was a friend of mine. But there was some stuff in my files, which is pretty hard to believe, but it said that Potter's basis was Jewish. For more than three decades, William Potter Gale warned the world that a satanic Jewish conspiracy disguised as communism was corrupting public officials and the courts, undermining the United States and wrecking its divinity inspired by the Constitution. Jews, the self-described reverend taught, were offspring of the devil, while non-whites were mud people, and the whites were the real Hebrews of the Bible. By the time of his death in 1988, Bill Gale had spent half a lifetime energetically promoting his particular bloodthirsty brand of anti-Semitism across America. Well, he did a good job. He was one of the leaders of the tax rebellion during the Vietnam War, traveled all over the country, and then he became leader of the Committee of the States. There's quite an extensive book, about 400 pages, on the Committee of the States if you want to look it up. He wanted me to join, but by that time I didn't trust any organizations. I didn't want any part of any membership organizations, so I told him, "Good luck, but not me." Quote, "Arise and fight," Gale preached in one famous sermon broadcast to Kansas City farmers in 82. "If a Jew comes near you, run a sword through him." Yeah, he used to be pretty wild. I remember when he said in a sermon in L.A. that if any of these JDL, any of these Jews screw with you, grab them and hang them from the overpass on the freeway. But William Potter Gale had a secret. It turns out that Gale, founder of the Jew-hating Posse Comitatus that raged through the Midwest in the 1970s and 80s, was descended on his father's side from a long time of devout Jews. Well, it wouldn't technically count with the Jews if he descended from his father's side. In interviews with his author for a book being published this fall, Gale's daughters revealed with some bemusement the Jewish roots of their grandfather and his forebears. Ironically, like so many other 19th century Jews from Eastern Europe, Bill Gale's father, Charles, was fleeing Russian anti-Semitism and seeking economic opportunity when he arrived in the United States in 1894. Changing his name from Grabiker, Grabiker, in the process, 4 years later, Charles, then 18, lied about his age and place of birth in order to join the U.S. Army. But he was truthful enough to declare on his military enlistment papers that his parents' nationality was Hebrew. While Charles Gale eventually abandoned Judaism, married a non-Jew, and raised his children as Christians, all of his siblings proudly embraced their religious heritage. It's a long article. I won't read it all, but if anybody wanted a photocopy of it, I would photocopy and send it to him. It's Daniel Levitas. Of course, he's a big-time anti-us author of The Terrorist Next Door, The Militia Movement and the Radical Right, Thomas Dune Books, St. Martin's Press, November 2002. Well, since I submit that Jews are technically not a race, they're parts of all kinds of races, homogenized. I've always said that I think, to be fair, a Jew can quit being a Jew. Say, I don't want to be a Jew no more. I want to be something else. Maybe not Aryan, but pro-Aryan. And I know I've met some of these kind of guys down through time. So I would not hold that against Bill Gale because of his grandfather way back. You know, that's like these guys that said, you got a nigger way five generations back in your family, but your family had bred true to their race ever since. Well, obviously, you wouldn't show any sign of Negro physically or skin or anything like that, and so technically you got to say, hell yes, you're white. I mean, if you look white, act white, think white, walk white, fight white, you're white. But I would never get down on Bill Gale because he was a hell of a man, a hell of a guy. And if it was his grandfather that quit being a Jew. Yeah, he just quit. Well, Baptists quit being Baptists. Methodists quit being Methodists. So why can't a Jew quit being a Jew? Well, anyhow, that's been my position for quite a while. I think it's reasonable. Some of the right wing say, oh, you're a race traitor, you're this, you're that, because Jews are a race. No, Jews technically aren't a race. You can't prove that to me. They did con the Congress to including them in on hate crimes as a race, but it was totally fraudulent and not true. Now, they are an ethnicity, and there are lots of Jews, people who call themselves Jews, that lived side by side for long periods of time, but that's not the same as being a race. Now, here's something I found that I had written down that I didn't realize, and that was the goings-on at the March the 15th, 1980 riot in Oceanside, California. That was, we were celebrating Andrew Jackson's birthday, the first president, the only president who ever brought the national debt to zero. But there's some people who didn't like that fact. So they showed up to give us trouble. So I wrote this up. I don't even remember what I wrote. March 6, 1980, 8:30 to 10:30 a.m., City of Oceanside briefing on security arrangements for the rally. Tom Metzger and Don Musgrove met with Mr. Hensey, Chief of Oceanside Police Department, Captain Robert Smith, Assistant City Attorney Mr. Bossier, and two or three other officers. At this time, the Klan officials were told Captain Smith would be in charge of the police detail, which would be in charge of security for which the Klan had a permit. Chief Hensey said that 1,000 to 2,000 anti-Klan demonstrators were coming from San Diego and Los Angeles. Chief Hensey asked Mr. Metzger whether he realized that these people were going to try to kill him personally. Chief Hensey said that based on their intelligence, demonstrators would attack the Klan in general, but some of these people were planning to kill Tom Metzger for sure no matter what else happened. Tom Metzger replied that he realized the possibility of being killed by the communists at the Landis Park, but the alternative would be to surrender our rights to the free speech and assembly to the communist terrorists. Tom Metzger said, we either have free speech and freedom of assembly in this country, or we do not. Sounds sort of like the usual newspapers. So what's happening now is stuff that I went through all during the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. nobody was out there like on Fox TV crying their eyes out about my people and myself. So I don't cry at all for them when they go out there and the neo-Bolsheviks try to rip them up. Because they don't give a shit about us. Captain Smith said he was putting up a security fence to keep the demonstrators from attacking his men in the wall and the hall. You get that? Putting up a chain link fence to protect his men and the hall, not us. Tom Metzger and Don Musgrove related being attacked by the Progressive Labor Party, PLP, in Oxnard, California, and how Klansmen had to fight unarmed against the PLP with over 200 street people. Captain Smith said Deputy Chief Papa George of Oxnard had admitted he blew it. Well, he did blow it because the day the riot started, he left town and went to Mexico on vacation. That's how he blew it. By disregarding the Klan warnings about the PLP, Captain Smith said, if those rioters move against my people, that's it. All bets are off, unquote. The only people he moved against was us as we were leaving the park. This remark by Captain Smith was made pursuant to Tom Metzger asking if the police were attacked, would they use their guns? Tom Metzger and Don Musgrove said that 9 concerned police were hospitalized because they were surprised and abandoned each other while afraid to draw their guns in Oxnard. I saw one cop in Oxnard in the riot with his police helmet split right down the middle, blood streaming down his face. And they had one cop pinned up against the front door. We were inside, and they were pinned up the front door, and these Marxists were clubbing the shit out, and they were going to kill him. We opened the door and grabbed him and pulled him in and saved his life. Never get any credit for that kind of stuff. Captain Smith said the situation was such that he could not guarantee our safety. Cops with guns can't guarantee our safety. And generally concluded the meeting when he turned to Tom Metzger and Don Musgrove and said, quote, remember, we're not going to allow you to have guns in the hall. All Klan members will have to check in their guns at the door, unquote. We took this as being a police instruction that the situation required and expected the Klan to have legal firearms and weapons with them. On March 7th, 1980, Tom Metzger filed as a candidate for the 43rd District of the House of Representatives of the Congress of the United States. On March 8, 1980, at 7 p.m., Tom Metzger and James Hansen went with Oceanside Police Department for a last-minute security arrangement. Tom Metzger volunteered and brought a video camera tape footage of both the Oxnard and the Castro Valley riots. Tom Metzger also brought physical examples of a weapon used against police and Klan members in Oxnard. It was a 12-inch piece of pipe wrapped in newspapers. Tom Metzger showed the videotapes of Captain Smith, Lieutenant Dunn, and 3 other officers. Yeah, they had a van parked about 4 blocks from the Oxnard community building, and they had pipe cutters, and they were cutting off these pieces, longer pieces of pipe into 12-inchers and then pasting their communist paper around it. And they used these like mortars to throw over the front guys to hit other people in the head. And that's, you know, getting hit in the head with a 12-inch piece of galvanized pipe can really do you in. Captain Smith gave Tom Metzger 2 pieces of paper detailing their plans. Captain Smith told Tom Metzger that he would stay in touch by phone and Tom Metzger could reach him at number given. I want you to understand, this is the last time I ever trusted cops for anything. Absolutely anything. Some of us almost got killed. We didn't get hurt, but it wasn't because of the cops. Lieutenant Dunn also gave Tom Metzger his card and said that he would be calling Tom Metzger as a scheduled event of the Klan drew closer. On Monday, March 10, 1980, at 4:30 p.m., Oceanside City Manager Robert Boissier called Tom Metzger's home. He said an emergency city council meeting would be held at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, March 11th. And that was a bunch of chicken shit city council members. They cave into anything. The emergency council meeting was attended by the entire city council, city attorney, city manager, Oceanside chief of police, Captain Smith, and others. Police Chief Ralph Hensey addressed the council in regards to a letter from his office to the council. Chief Hensey said 1,500 to 2,000 leftist demonstrators were coming and that he could not assure the safety of Oceanside. Well, he had no way of knowing how many people were coming, and it certainly wasn't that many. There might have been 200 at the most, the way it turned out. Mayor Graham spoke to the audience, asked if Tom Metzger was present. This was affirmative. Mayor Graham stated that he was canceling the permit for Landis Park Hall for March 15, 1980. Now, this was a former Marine general from Camp Pendleton who became mayor of Oceanside, another chicken shit military man. Tom Metzger addressed the city council and said, "This issue here is First Amendment." Rights of freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, unquote. Tom Metzger continued by saying that the city council and the mayor were surrendering the streets of Oceanside to the mob, and that it could happen to the Klan today, it could happen to any other group tomorrow. And now you see it is happening. After all these years, it's happening again. Goody Two Shoes, Fox TV, and all them are all crying and crying the blues. But none of those people, absolutely none, were crying for our freedom of speech back then. In fact, they blamed us. It was all your fault, just like they did the guys in Charlottesville who just went there to march. It's an old tactic. The system plays the bad boy game. Mayor Graham interrupted Tom Metzger, stating his responsibility was to the city of Oceanside. Well, I had no responsibility to the city of Oceanside. I didn't live in the city of Oceanside. Tom Metzger replied to the mayor that it's his responsibility, the mayor's, was to uphold the Constitution of the United States. At this point, the Oceanside Mayor Graham became visibly angry and adjourned the meeting. He came up after the meeting and shook his finger in my face and said, "Don't show up here on the date you had planned to. Just don't show up." I said, "We'll be here, General." Tom Metzger went to the rear of the hall to depart. Well, here it was. Mayor Graham rushed up to Tom Metzger, pointed his finger in Tom Metzger's face and said, quote, "Don't let me see you in Oceanside on Saturday," unquote. Tom Metzger replied, "You may surrender your streets to the communists, but I won't." Note, General Graham is in fact makes all the decisions, but always demands that his subordinates make it look as though it was their idea. This is especially true when General Graham makes bad decisions. City Manager Robert Boissier was interviewed on local television after the meeting. Mr. Boissier said that since the Klan permit has been revoked, 1,500 to 2,000 demonstrators would not show up. Now, how would he know that? He thought. City Manager Boissier said that the demonstrators could not be kept from the park and did not need a permit. Tom Metzger reasoned that if the communist groups did not need a permit to go to Landis Park, then the Klan would not need a permit to go to the Landis Park either. City Manager Boissier said the police security arrangements were going to be the same as if the Klan permit had not been canceled. Tom Metzger and Don Musgrove took this statement that the police security agreements with Tom Metzger, Don Musgrove, and the Klan were still in force if the Klan showed up in Landis Park, that the police still expected the Klan to show up, and the Klan permit cancellation was merely a ruse to discourage anti-Klan demonstrators to show up and cause trouble at Landis Park. Klan officials were further encouraged that the Klan police security arrangements were still standing by the complete absence of Oceanside Police Department efforts to notify the Klan that the Klan was not to be welcome. Captain Smith personally had promised, had phoned Tom Metzger to alert Tom Metzger to any real arrangement changes regardless of what happened in the press. This was done because Captain Smith had said to Tom Metzger and Don Musgrove that the news could not be counted upon as accurate means of communications, and had personally signed a map of Atlantis Park with his phone number to further underscore that direct phone calls between Tom Metzger and Captain Smith were to be the only calls relied upon for security decisions. Note, Merrick Graham was never present during any security meetings that occurred between the Oceanside Police Department and the Klan officials. Therefore, the Klan officials were surprised at his apparent command authority over the Oceanside Police Department forces on the day of the meeting at Atlantis Park. On March 15, 1980, the Klan convoy of cars arrived on Thomas Street in Oceanside from an eastern approach from Emerald Street. The Klan officials unloaded their occupants and then left the area to prevent the assault upon the vehicles and drivers with lead pipes or pieces of concrete. See, that's why we did that. We didn't pull right up like most guys would do, pull our cars up in front of the hall, because we knew our cars would be torn to bits if we did that. Note, vehicles' reason for not involving them. The key reasons that the incident at Greensboro took place was that a communist confessed to the shooting out of a tire of a leading Klan car, which also caused the Klan cars and the drivers behind them to come to a halt, then be swamped by Communist Workers' Party. Source FBI and Greensboro report. Also, the Klan car that stopped or was stopped was driven by an undercover police informant, and his stopping caused the other Klan cars in a caravan to be stuck in line and to be involved in the incident whether they wanted to or not. That's from Frontline Report, KBBS, 1983. Continuing at Oxnard, California, July 31, 1978, the Progressive Labor Party, PLP, had smashed the police car's windows with steel pipes, and the police officers floored the gas pedal and drove partially blind down the street. At the San Ysidro American-Mexican border checkpoint in October 77, a communist by the name of Mercado was convicted of smashing the windshield of a Klansman's automobile while he, the Klansman, was trying peacefully to leave the area. I forgot about that riot. Sometime after that, I took David Duke to the border and we got attacked down there. Yeah, and we were inside the port of entry and the Marxists were throwing eggs and stuff. They hit a Mexican gal right in the face. Didn't hit any of our people. The Klan, March 15, 1980, approached Landis Park from the north on the sidewalk to the right of their line of march. The time was between 2 and 3 o'clock. Anti-Klan demonstrators were visible and moving about the park. Now also, we had taken over the coin-operated telephone booths. We put one out of order and had a man at the other one so none of the Marxists could reach the payphones around the park. We had those totally tied up. So, because we were in communications with my office back in Fallbrook, California, where we had people standing by in case anybody was hurt. We had a couple of nurses there, too, in case anybody was hurt. Klan members observed a few bats and bottles hidden among the crowd. The crowd appeared not to be a single coalition, as had been carried in the news, but rather a few scattered gangs of communist agitators surrounded by curious and large numbers of street rabble. This is exactly the same thing that happened in Charlottesville. Exactly. The loose conglomeration of anti-Klan people were subdued into relative silence and resignation to the entry of the Klan into the park. Their eyes were on the Klan equipment and the determination by Klansmen to repel any criminal attack on their person. No member of the crowd individually was willing to initiate an assault upon a Klansman equipped with specifically to repel such an assault. We had a couple of guys even had legally carried guns. They were never used, however. The equipment and rapid approach and deployment diffused and deterred the attack. The Klan on site strategy that the communists had instilled in their followers. The appearance of the Klan's equipment provoked an outbreak of peace among the communist terrorists. For over 30 minutes, the anti-Klan crowd listened to Tom Metzger pay a tribute to President Andrew Jackson and then went into an explanation that the Klan had come to Landis Park to demonstrate that the Klan had just as much right to free speech and assembly in the free marketplace of ideas as would any other group. Tom Metzger further enumerated that the Klan respected the rights of even anti-Klan demonstrators and communists to have an orderly meeting and to speak on any issue of their choice. Believe me, they don't give a shit. You know, there's no moderation with these people. So when they attack, you have to brutally attack them back. That's the only way, thing they understand. The communist agitators were restrained by the presence of over 100 police officers towards their rear and the right flanks and by the Klan directly opposite of their front. Approximately 10 minutes before the end of Tom Metzger's speech, small rocks and paper cups began emanating from the rear members of the crowd who were less than 20 feet away from the police. The police did nothing, and many members of the anti-Klan crowd could see the police seemed amused by their conduct. Tom Metzger then announced that the Klan was going to march once around across Landis Park and then peacefully leave the area. Tom Metzger then led the column. This is big paper. The Klansman 50 feet west and then ordered a column left, so the Klan column began walking about 100 feet south. At the beginning of this march, the crowd began to follow, and a barrage changed from small articles to large rocks and beer bottles. Tom Metzger at this point realized that the crowd was in process of beginning an all-out assault upon the Klan and intended to do great bodily harm to the persons of the Klan. Tom Metzger proceeded south towards the community center, where the command post of Oceanside Police Department's 100 policemen were located. As the column marched south towards the police, the pursuing mob was now throwing many quart-sized beer bottles, large rocks, and large pieces of concrete. And the police had done nothing. As the Klan column turned left, proceeding by the north wall of Landis Park, Tom Metzger's face shield was smashed by a flying stone. No Klansman made a sound as beer bottles, large rocks, and pieces of concrete rained upon them and hit their legs, shoulders, backs, and helmets and shields. The reporters had their cameras aimed at the Klansmen in preconception that only Klansmen were capable of a crime. The news people were all, for the most part, unaware of the potential lethal-sized objects thrown at the Klan because the objects disappeared into the Klan ranks without a sound, muffled by that fact that they were hitting the bodies of Klansmen. But the Klansmen made no sound nor reached for their pain to betray a wound to the enemy. This illusion of only paper cups and harmless debris being thrown at the Klan persisted until one of the news people was struck in the back of the head by a paper cup made of concrete. Don Musgrove witnessed a chunk of concrete hitting a lady. She was next to the Klan column facing west towards the Klan. They don't care who they hit or who they hurt, these kind of people. That's why they have to be handled brutally. That's the only way. Cops used to do that, but they don't do it anymore. Tom Metzger and the Klan column were now temporarily stopped by a steel fence in the community center where the California Highway A highway patrolman was stationed and some Oceanside Police Department cars were parked. Rocks rained down on those vehicles. Also, the Klan repelled a child's bicycle being thrown at them. I remember that. All of this happened within 20 feet from the main body of the Oceanside Police Force unit, and yet they had not moved. a California Highway Patrol officer had no helmet, so he dived under and crawled under his vehicle to escape the bombardment and projectiles. Some hero. Some keeper of the peace. I remember that as well today as I did back then. Clear as a bell, this stupid cowardly highway patrolman hiding under his car. At this point, many Oceanside Police Department officers could be seen smiling by both the mob and the Klan through the chain-link fence as the Klan suffered the assault from the mob. The cops were totally protected on the other side of the fence. Tom Metzger and the Klan members now knew that all along the Oceanside Police Department was there not only for one reason, not to preserve the peace or to restrain the rioters, nor to separate so-called anti-Klan from Klan members. Now you see how close this mirrors exactly what happened in Charlottesville? I think if anybody's charged down there on the alt-right side, they should have this document. The Oceanside Police Department was there to ensure that no one interfered with the mob's assault on the Klan. The police were there to attack the Klan at the slightest indication that the Klan, sought to protect itself. It was a setup. Even though many Klan members were hurting from the projectiles thrown at them, they did not respond and take the bait of the police trap. The Klan members were far more knowledgeable in the law and were disciplined to the degree General Graham and his OPD had thought not possible. Tom Metzger had now directed the Klan column north up Cedar Street on the sidewalk to withdraw from the area. Members of the mob were racing alongside the Klan column, attacking the rear and the side of the column, trying to prevent the Klan from leaving the area, trying to trap us. The mob was far more aggressive than normal, for they now knew that the OPD was on their side. As the Klan column passed the intersection of Lewis Street and Lewis Road traveling north, it was being cut off from its line of withdrawal and was in immediate danger of being overrun by the mob. To prevent this, Tom Metzger ordered a repelling attack. The Klan members previously had been instructed to limit their repelling attack against the mob from about 20 to 30 feet distant. The Klansmen had been reviewing particular individuals who were recognized as adult communist agitators, and members of the Klan column had suffered a barrage of heavy projectiles for a half an hour while the assailants continued their cowardly attack with protection from the Oceanside Police Department. The Klansmen checked their repelling action and regrouped after a 30-foot repelling movement, but at that particular movement of being ordered to repel the rioters, it was like a mob of emotion being set off by the angry Klansmen. I wonder if any of those right-wingers know what a repelling action is. The communists, who had been attacking for over a half hour with unrestrained lethal force, were fortunate. They were not killed in the brief 30 seconds of the Klan's repelling attack. See, Randy Evans was there, later to become an order member. Now that Klan showed that its behavior had been restrained during the attack, rather than cowered by the attacking mob, the mob began to fall back and let the Klan withdraw from the area. At this point, a sheriff's helicopter appeared overhead, but no one paid attention because it had been hovering over the area for about 40 minutes, and besides, the only thing anyone could hear was the screaming of the mob. At this point, OPD officers, who were formed up in front of Landis Hall, began to advance up Cedar Street. Tom Metzger assumed that the police would seal off the intersection at Lewis Street and Cedar Road while the Klan continued to withdraw. OPD realized that the communist-led mob had failed to cripple or kill the Klan column, and that now the OPD felt only that they had the necessary force to pursue the Klan up the hill, provoking a Klan response, and then cripple and kill as many Klan members as possible, because they had come to the city of Oceanside to participate in an American political system of a free marketplace of ideas as advocated by the Chief Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. The Klan had now reached the top of the hill at Cedar Road and Thomas Street. It was at this location that a Klan convoy of cars was supposed to pick up the Klan column as they withdrew from the area. Unknown to the Klan column at the time, the OPD had set up a roadblock to prevent the Klan vehicles from picking up Klan members so that the Klan could withdraw from the area. Drivers of the Klan vehicles told the police officers that they were there to pick up Klansmen 3 blocks from Landis Park. The cars were refused entrance to Thomas Street, in other words, trapping the Klan, forcing the Klan members to march another block and a half to gain access to their vehicles. Klan officers never saw Chief of Police Rolf Hensley in the field. They only saw Mayor Graham and Captain Smith leading the police 4 blocks up the hill past the intersection of Cedar Road and Thomas Street. Finally, the OPD overtook and attacked the Klan on Thomas Street. Now get this, they did not attack the rioting Marxists who were going after us, and they were being shielded by the cops as they threw shit over their heads at us. Then the Klan paused because Don Musgrove went to the side of the street and requested a car out of the area. He was a cystic fibrosis patient, and he'd run out of steam. Cops didn't give a shit about that. Don Musgrove had cystic fibrosis and could not breathe and could not go on. Tom Metzger asked Captain Smith also to have a car take Don Musgrove out of the immediate area. Tom Metzger said to Captain Smith, quote, "We are not resisting. We simply have slowed down in an attempt to evacuate Don Musgrove from this area," unquote. Captain Smith stepped forward and touched Don Musgrove in the stomach with his baton as to check if Don Musgrove indeed was exhausted. At this point, Lieutenant Dunn and other officers attacked Don Musgrove. At least one police dog was turned on Don Musgrove. Tom Metzger was attempting to show non-resistance, as neither he or Don Musgrove had shields or weapons, but at the same time was physically attempting to move Don Musgrove out of danger. The Klan chief of security, Edgar Letson, had a Doberman dog on a leash. Letson's dog attempted to fight a police dog that was biting Don Musgrove. At that moment, the Oceanside police officer from at least 3 rows back in the formation thrust his gun between 2 officers and shot and killed the Doberman. Then the shot was fired. There was a momentary freeze of action. Tom Metzger shouted to the police, "Cool it! Have you gone crazy?" As Don Musgrove was pulled out of the way of the oncoming police, Tom Metzger, Edgar Letson, and others who had presumed their withdrawal up Thomas Street to the east were beaten and shoved to the ground several times by the Oceanside police cops. One Klansman was beaten on the ground by the Oceanside police officers, inflicting a broken collarbone upon the Klansman. As Don Musgrove was pulled out of the way of oncoming police, Tom Metzger, Edgar Letson, and other Klan officers assisted several neighborhood residents out of the way and into their houses from the cops. Klan officers advised the residents to lock their doors and get into their houses. That's not the cops helping these people, it was us. The only injuries sustained by Klan members were police dog bites and injuries inflicted by police batons. The Klan members walked a total of 5 blocks away from Landis Park to meet their vehicles that had been rerouted due to the blockade by the police and left. Well, I guess I'll go on. It's going to be a longer show. Summary. Since the events of March 15, 1980, Tom Metzger learned that his personal bodyguard, Mr. Douglas K. Seymour, was on the payroll of the San Diego Police Department according to court documents filed by Mr. Seymour's wife in a divorce action. Also, evidence had connected Mr. Seymour to an FBI agent in San Diego. Evidence has been collected that D.K. Seymour had a history of psychiatric treatment leading to hospitalization sometime after the events of March 15, 1980 in Oceanside, California. Mr. D.K. Seymour did hold a concealed weapons permit during the entire association with Tom Metzger. This permit was issued by the San Diego Sheriff's Department and was renewed after the Oceanside incident. There's much more information and video evidence, including the fact that the San Diego police intelligence officers were among the rioters from the beginning to the end, while numerous felonies took place before their eyes without making arrests. At the same time, 100 police stood by in formation for approximately a half an hour before moving and then becoming part of the problem and not the solution. In conclusion, after the reflection and the review of the evidence and the revelation of police informant activity, I must conclude that the San Diego Police Department, the San Diego Sheriff's, and the Oceanside Police Department conspired in an attempt to create a gunfight between communists and Klan members, thus giving them legal excuse to fire on both groups. When the first plan failed, I believe the police followed the Klan members even after they had followed dispersal orders and were over 2.5 blocks away from the park site, attempting to reach their automobiles. As Klan members kept moving away, police attacked in an attempt to create a showdown, hoping the Klan discipline would break, which was what they were waiting on. So that's it. I and a lot of my men could have been wiped out that day. That was what was planned. So I have no sympathy for these people that don't listen, because I've been through it several times before. And you cannot trust any cops, federal agents, anybody in the system power. You cannot trust them at all. I learned that on that day. I vowed to never trust a cop, and I never will again. That's it for today, boys and girls. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you learned something by it. Terrible Tommy, off and clear, and I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the Bunker.